You're with the Country Breakfast on RN. Time to find out what our rural reporters have been up to. This week we introduce you to a South Australian couple who are committed to developing Australia's bush food market. Grey Nomads fossick for gold in the Pilbara, and an old dried fruit dip tins get a trendy makeover. We also visit a Boer goat farm and harvest native grass tree stems for the international flower market.
You can twist it and tie it and bend it. You can cut it in half. You can create a vertical line or an arched line, and it's used in flower arrangements, and it goes all over the world.
Steel grass stems travelling all the way from the Byfield Forest in central Queensland to the famous flower markets of Amsterdam. That story coming up later in the program, but let's start today with some other native bush tucker plants that are destined for a supermarket shelf near you.
Here in Reedy Creek, we'll go for a bit of a walk and I'll show you some of the fresh stuff.
I am a plant whisperer, I hope, from way back, and I just love making plants happy. And if it also then means that Australia can be proud because it has its own Australian cuisine at long last, which has always been there, but they haven't noticed it, maybe contributed something.
A quick question for you. How many of Australia's 2,500 native bush foods do you think you've tried? Have you ever heard of kwandongs, for example, or tanami apples? Well, thanks to South Australian couple Mike and Gail Quamby, our general knowledge and access to native bush tucker has improved enormously in recent years. Hello, I'm Danielle Grindley. Back in 2001, the Quambys started a bush food cooperative called Outback Pride. They wanted to record and propagate native bush food species that were growing in the outback, and then empower the local Aboriginal communities to cultivate and sell the plants.
So I spent 6 or 8 months out bush with Aboriginal elders, finding the last remaining stands of the best bush foods. And we did 250,000 kilometres doing that process. And then with all our facilities here, we bought seed, cutting material back here of those best selections, and then worked out how to propagate them, to cultivate them. Then we invented the machinery and dragged it all the way back out. In the meantime, the grapevine happened, and where we thought we were going to help one or two communities, we, in 2003, we assessed 16 communities and put in 6 gardens, big gardens. This is a mixture of old Catra, wattle seed, lemon myrtle, mountain pepper and saltbush. Have a taste, just a pinch of it. We have signed an MOU with each of the communities that we've done, which says that we will not put a PVR, in other words, plant variety protection, on any species. That belongs to them. And we won't sell bush food plants to any other Australians other than Indigenous people.
Mike and Gail's main nursery is here in Reedy Creek in South Australia's southeast. The couple estimate they've propagated about 500,000 bush food plants in the past decade, helping some 26 Aboriginal communities along the way. Many of the plants were on the verge of extinction.
We drive usually about 1,200 kilometres a day out bush. You could write a book about every single species and you still wouldn't have discovered all the tricks about them. So we've travelled the length and breadth of the outback with the help of Aboriginal people to find things that are really different, you know, really unusual. Then we've got to work out how to propagate them. And then when we start that, we realise that some are different to others. So we do lots of seedling testing and all that sort of thing. This is an interesting one. Munyaru is the most common Aboriginal name. This grows all the way along the track, Oodnadatta track. If Burke and Wills had eaten this, which happens to be one of the most important Aboriginal foods in that area, they would have well and truly survived.
After years of hard work, the Quambys believe they're finally making an impact in everyday Australian cuisine. And this year, for the first time, they hope to make a profit.
What we didn't really count on was the apathetic attitude of Australians towards their own cuisine.
There's some 2,500 Australian native food plants that Indigenous people ate. When the Poms came out, they brought four of theirs, you know, and we've been eating them ever since. We actually had these things in Coles stores back in 2001, but it didn't take off because people didn't know what they were. So we had to wait until the chefs started to serve it and actually advertise that they had these things.
Kylie Kwong is, you know, she's a lovely lady in Sydney, and we've been getting to her restaurant boxes of hand-picked things from Reedy Creek. But we've always been very careful not to overstimulate the market without being able to sustainably supply in an ethical sense. We adore our distributors around Australia and for overseas. And so many times they come back to us and say, oh, but, you know, Jamie Oliver wants 100 kilos of something to go in Coles next week. And we say, well, come on, mate. Be real.
We're the first people to ever cultivate most of these things. That's the flowers on the Marsdenia, which are chock-a-block full of nectar, absolutely beautiful. One of the challenges we've had is that, of course, the kids love eating the flowers, and they'll eat all the flowers and we don't get any fruit, but, you know, it's one of those things.
Come on! Come on!
Doesn't sound like they're too hungry.
No.
Just 10 years ago, this small, rough bush block near Tallarook in northern Victoria was overrun with a woody weed called China Bush. But now, thanks to some very hungry livestock, this 240-hectare property has been transformed into rolling green pastures and is now able to supply Melbourne restaurants with top-notch gourmet goat meat. G'day, I'm James Eurster, and we're calling in the Boer goats here on Taylan Atar's property. G'day, how's it going? I'm trying to find the goats.
Oh, okay.
So how many of them are out here through the paddocks?
Through this paddock there's probably, I don't know, 45, 50.
And those are the Boer goats?
Boer goats, yep, absolutely. But there's 600 acres here and there's probably just on 1,000.
Okay, right. Wow, so there's quite a few of them spread out.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, absolutely.
Is that a manageable number?
Look, in our peak, we ran about 2,500.
Okay.
So that was not manageable. Our feed cost was somewhere around 25 to 30 grand a month. But this land's quite barren. You know, all this pasture you see is what the goats have put in. 10 years ago or 12 years ago, you couldn't have seen me standing this close.
There was, oh, wow,
that much China bush and stuff. Yeah, so if you have a look what it was and what it is now.
There's basically a lot of woodland around and then I guess just the grass is left.
That's right. So we have a weed or a bush out here that's called China bush.
Yep.
That stabilises the soil, so it's a good bush, but you can't do much with it, and it doesn't matter whether you cut it or burn it, or it just doesn't go away. But the goats, I don't know what they do to it, but they keep picking at it enough times, and over the last 10 years, you know, this bush block or forest block has now turned into all pasture.
So they're a natural fit?
Yeah, absolutely.
And they enjoy, obviously, hooking into it, because there's just, you wouldn't even have known there was that much China bush around if you just walked onto the place now like I did, so.
That's right, and if you have a look over here on the ground, that's the natural state of the ground, and if you have a look into the distance now, over the 10 years, the goats have put enough back into the soil that we've now got topsoil, so.
Wow.
Yeah, it's good.
Quite a transformation. Oh, here they come.
So, they're my boys, who are 7, 8 and 9.
Rounding them up. Here they come. That's quite a march they've got coming towards us.
Actually, might be close to 100 in there.
Right. Are they quite manageable?
Yeah, they're good. They're. I look at them much like Labradors, you know. They follow you around and they're very curious. If we're fencing or doing something in the paddocks, they'll come up to you. And so, you know, if they were sheep, they would have scattered everywhere. Come have a close look.
How much would one of the bigger ones of these goats weigh?
Well, these goats here are probably about 9 to 12 months old. So they will grow in this group to about 50 kilos. But a good-sized boar goat can grow up to 75, 80 kilos, no problem.
So what's the weight you'd send them off to then become dinner?
In the early days, so a few years ago, most people wanted a small goat, 10, 12 kilogram carcasses. But over the years, we've managed to talk them up and start using bigger, large carcasses. So the average weight that restaurants now take is between 18 and 20 kilos, which is great. We deal with top-end restaurants in Melbourne, and I work with 35 other producers to be able to supply just Melbourne. Obviously, the TV shows, the master chefs, they've all helped contribute to a big uptake in the goat meat.
Are they an easier type of livestock to run? I mean, are they generally an easy type of laid-back stock to run?
No, they're not. Contrary to belief, they don't just eat anything. They don't eat tin cans. They don't eat your clothes off the washing line. You'll see by their arched backs, they're actually the opposite direction to sheep and cattle. They're actually designed to get up on two legs and browse. And here in Australia, of course, they're forced to eat off the ground, which causes a slightly higher worm problem. So their maintenance is probably a little bit higher than normal. But again, it's dependent on grazing and rotation of paddocks. So the more you can do that, the easier they are to look after.
What brought you into goats?
A bush block. You know, this was arid land that was unfarmable, and when I bought the place, they said it would never be turned into a farm. And, you know, 12 or 13 years on, we've got a pristine, beautiful farm that's almost looks manicured. We don't cut this grass, this is what the goats do.
Boer goat breeder Taylan Atars speaking with our reporter James Euster on his bush block near Tallarook in central Victoria. Still to come today, gold fever hits the Pilbara, steel grass stems have florists in a twist, and old fruit tins get a trendy makeover.
See that one there? That's made out of mesh, and on the end it's got the punch. Some people now, when they come looking here to buy them, they call them fruit baskets. Like once upon a time they were everywhere, but they're getting pretty scarce now. And they're paying good money for them now.
And another one down here that's only got holes in the end and it's plain each side.
They say that one person's trash is another's treasure, and for Don Wilson, that couldn't be more true. And when you're talking about a small bucket that's literally full of drainage holes, it takes on even more significance. Who could possibly find a use for that? Hello, I'm Sophie Malcolm at Cabarita near Mildura in northwest Victoria, where these special tins were put to good use in the early days of the dried fruit industry. The fresh grapes being dipped in a special solution that would speed up the drying process.
Well, the dip tins, they used to pick the fruit off the vine straight into the dip tin. Then they'd take them up and put them through a dip, which put very fine splits in the skin. And then when they put the grapes on the racks, they dry a lot quicker.
Can you explain what it looks like, I suppose, in its most basic sort of form?
Most of them are galvanised and they're about 18 inches long, about a foot wide and about 6 inches deep, and they've got a handle on the top.
While the dip tins aren't used anymore to produce sultanas, they have found a new generation of admirers. They've become popular in trendy vintage shops, and Don's kept busy scouring old tips and fruit farms to find them.
Oh, a lot of young people looking for them there. They've become a bit trendy. Some paint them, some powder coat them, and I've even seen one that was brass plated, electro brass plated. Even the rusty tins, some prefer the rusty ones. Some are galvanised and some are just black steel. Of course, they go rusty.
How long have you been collecting them for?
Oh, probably 30-odd years.
And why? What do you like about them?
Oh, we used to demolish a lot of the fruit drying racks, and I noticed a lot of different sorts. Well, a few different sorts, so I put a few aside as I came across one. And the more I looked into it, the more different ones I found.
So some pretty unique ones. I think we're looking at one here that's been made out of a kerosene tin. What kind of, I guess, weird and wonderful sort of tins have you come across?
Oh, well, that one would be a kerosene tin or a fuel tin. That's how they used to get their petrol in the early days, about a 4-gallon square tin. Well, this one here, they've cut the side out of it and they've punched holes in it with probably a hand punch and a hammer. That was probably to save money, I'd say.
Do you think that all of those years ago when people were making these dip tins and using them, they would expect that they'd have such a long life expectancy and still be used, you know, all of these years later?
Oh, no, I don't think they would have. When we brought the dip tins back, initially when we were doing rack demolition, everyone else was scrapping them. See, they'd press them for scrap and away they'd go, and they weren't worth much back then. Well, I don't like destroying anything that might ever use. Not only dip tins, a lot of other things too.
You like collecting things, like bringing them back and giving them a new home?
Oh yeah, we reckon that we were into recycling before they invented the word.
You can twist it and tie it and bend it. You can cut it in half. You can create a vertical line or an arched line, and it's used in flower arrangements, and it goes all over the world.
When Keith Jaffray was a young man, he lived in the Netherlands, just around the corner from Amsterdam's famous flower market. Now he supplies that very same market with what's known as steel grass, the long, spindly, narrow leaves that grow on native grass trees.
Be careful, some of these vines are spiky.
Hello, I'm Kathleen Calderwood in the Byfield State Forest on the Capricorn Coast in central Queensland. It's here that Keith has the lease to harvest the leaves from the grass trees, which grow naturally in the forest.
They grow new foliage all the time, particularly in rainfall conditions. They're active growers, and we harvest the leaves from the grass trees, and usually about 18 months later we can come back and harvest the same plant again. And we only harvest a small percentage of the leaves, around about 20%, because anything that's old and damaged isn't wanted, and anything that is too young has no vase life. We just harvest green, clean, waxy, mature leaves.
Where are you supplying?
Well, we supply an exporter from Queensland, and they mainly send it to Europe. It flies straight into Holland, and then from Holland it's distributed to every European country as well as the UK, Canada and the USA. There's also shipments go to China and Japan, Taiwan, and the Middle East.
And do they attract a reasonable price?
We don't get a really lot of money here for it, unfortunately. But because we can get volumes of it, we can make a living out of it. It's quite cheap here in Australia, but by the time it arrives at its overseas destination, its price is multiplied. And when you consider between me harvesting it and the end user, there's 22 pairs of hands have handled the product. The product has gone up in value a lot. We try and send about 50 boxes a week with 4,000 stems in every box, but it varies depending on the seasons. If it's raining, we can't harvest. So if we have a big wet season, we have to wait until we can access areas. Boggy conditions restrict us, and also harvesting in the rain is very, very difficult.
10. 5 in a vase is a very nice display. Yeah.
You were saying earlier that you think there's a bit of a psychology to the product that you supply as well.
What we are doing, we're sending natural green wilderness products to the other side of the world where there is no natural green or wilderness left. People live in grey, black, sterile environments, and whether they realise it or not, we actually need green to have a healthy psychology, and it's okay for most of us here in Australia. We have quite a green environment, especially here in rural areas, but the bulk of the population of the world is now living in cities, and they still need nature in their lives. They're actually buying nature that comes from the other side of the world.
When you hear that sweet little sound, you think, ah, oh, this has got to be a nugget. And every day you wake up, even if you haven't found anything the day before, you go out with full optimism that you're definitely going to find something today.
To say that Greg Peter Monte and his wife Lynn have got gold fever is something of an understatement. This grey nomad couple from Port Lincoln in South Australia are not only prospecting for their own nuggets, they're turning other people's finds into pieces of fine jewellery as well.
We'd actually become very hooked on it all.
Yeah.
We're obsessed with it.
G'day, I'm Lucy Bell in the gold prospecting hotspot of Marble Bar in Western Australia's remote Pilbara region. Greg's a goldsmith by trade, and he's turned his caravan into a mobile jewellery workshop.
Well, we've really got a travelling goldsmith shop. We've got rolling mills, we've got soldering jets, we've got drills for dremeling, all of the tools that are required to hand make jewellery. Out here, we've got the nicest piece I've made this trip so far is the dragonfly. It's all 18 karat gold outline, and then we've used small nuggets, I've actually found those nuggets, to put into the wings, and then I've done the body in 18 karat white gold, diamond set right through. I did do a map of Australia this morning, same design, and that has got Marble Bar nuggets in.
And what there a glisten in that sunshine as well.
I've even got Tassie on the bottom there, which is always forgotten. And what we would do with this, if, say for instance, you were born in Perth, we'd set a little diamond where Perth is. I started doing jewellery when I was 12 years old. I'm now 66. My uncle was a goldsmith, my brother's a goldsmith, and my son is a goldsmith.
So tell me, what's brought you on the road then?
Well, I retired 10 years ago and my son took over the business in Port Lincoln. When I retired, I started building houses, a bit similar to jewellery, only a little bit bigger. But I really got sick of that and missed the artistic side. So we decided, after a trip through the goldfields, when they found out that I was a goldsmith, they said, why don't you set up and come up and convert nuggets into jewellery? So I thought, gee, what a good idea. So we're doing it and we're loving it. Now, there's a nugget where I've set the Southern Cross in diamonds in it, just a flat nugget. And I've set the shape of the Southern Cross in it. Sold them. Here's a nugget Lynn's got that we're tumbling for someone. Have a look at that. 62 grams. It's still got the quartz in it. We're putting that in the tumbler just to brighten up the gold so that it shines up.
It fits very snugly in the palm of my hand.
Yeah.
Yes.
And is that how gold would normally look when people find it in the bush, surrounded by quartz?
No.
Not always. Ironstone often. Sometimes they get a slug that's just quite clean with nothing in it. This one has come off a quartz reef. And the lady was lucky enough to fall over it.
It really has that incredible glint and glow to it. It gets the heart pumping a little bit, doesn't it?
If we found something like that, we would do backflips. It took me a long time to find my first nugget. Unlike Lynn, she picked up a 10.2 grammer as her first nugget, and that was at Mosquito Creek.
Wow.
That was my first piece.
You must have been absolutely stoked.
We jumped, danced. Kissed, hug. Cried.
Had a bottle of red that night or two.
We actually had been searching for 6 weeks and hadn't found a thing.
I did find a little patch in sandstone where we picked up 48 nuggets in 4 days for a whole weight of about 11 grams. They were like fly specks, we call them. It's a silent machine. Normally you would put the gold in here, then you just wind the handle like so, and that extrudes the gold out a little bit thinner. And if you want plate, you run it through the plate section there. And once you've got it down small enough, we've got what we call draw plates. And that's over here. We just poke the wire into these small draw plate holes, grab a pair of pliers, and extrude it through till we get it down to the size we want.
Because gold's quite malleable, isn't it?
Yeah, very soft. You can pull 1 ounce of fine gold down to about 1.6 kilometres long if you've got the right equipment.
And what are some of the sort of most common requests that you get from people? What do people like to have their find turned into?
Oh, look, we're all grey nomads on the road and we've all got grandchildren, especially granddaughters. You know, stud earrings, maybe a pendant, and sometimes we do the odd ring.
What do you like about the trade?
I think it's the artistic part of it. Meeting the people, being able to look at a nugget or a stone of any sort, really, and working out a design after you talk to the person. Find out what sort of style of jewellery they like, then you sit down and you design something specifically for them.
Greg and Linny Piedamonte creating fine jewellery from the gold grey nomads are finding in Western Australia's Pilbara. Thanks to Lucy Bell for that story. You're with a Country Breakfast on RN. I'm Edwina Farley.